from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Tomorrow morning, early risers will have the opportunity to see a celestial trifecta, a blue supermoon coinciding with a total lunar eclipse. The moon will be closer to the Earth and brighter than usual as the eclipse nears, and it will also be the second full moon of the month. San Francisco State astronomy professor Andrew Fracknell, who actually teaches in the lifelong learning, the Osher Lifelong Learning at San Francisco State now, formerly, of course, for many years at Foothill College, is here with us to talk about this and maybe matters astronomical, if time permitting. But this is a pretty rare lunar event, and we'll find out about some maybe exciting other dispatches from the cosmos about, believe it or not, origins of gold in the universe and what Andy calls burping black holes. Anyway, good to have you back with us. Welcome.
It's nice to be with you, Mike.
Well, this is pretty exciting stuff. I mean, supermoon, blue moon, so many names that we have to sort through here. Give us a sense of what actually people can see if they get up early enough. And they're going to have to get up about, well, before 5 o'clock probably.
That's right. That's the bad news, is that it's an early morning eclipse. The big news here is that there's going to be a total eclipse of the moon, where the full moon goes slowly dark until it's completely in the Earth's shadow. That's the beautiful and visible thing that's happening tomorrow morning. The rest of it is coincidences in the calendar and in the motion of things. But if you've never seen an eclipse of the moon, it's really quite a spectacular sight. The full moon slowly goes dark. So you have many, many minutes and, in fact, more than an hour to enjoy the eclipse itself. It's not like the eclipse we had in August where it was only 2 minutes and if you blinked, it was gone. So if you can get up before the sun does tomorrow morning, the total eclipse begins about 4:52 in the morning, and it's over by 6:08. And then we slowly see the moon moving out of the Earth's shadow, so getting more and more lit up.
And you can see a dark reddish disk, really, huh?
Well, this is what's beautiful about total eclipses of the moon. When the moon is completely in the Earth's shadow, then light from the sun can only filter and refract through the Earth's atmosphere. And it turns out that red color bends more in the Earth's atmosphere than the bluish color. So when we have a total eclipse of the moon, light is bent through the Earth's atmosphere onto that dark moon, and the reddish light gives it this kind of blood moon, as the media call it, this dark red hue. And we can even measure the pollution of the Earth's atmosphere by how deeply red the eclipsed moon gets. But just getting up and looking at that beautiful full moon, which suddenly goes red, is an awesome sight.
Well, and you can actually, I think the whole eclipse ends about 6:08, but there, you can see the partial one till about 7:11.
7:11, easy number to remember. So any time in the morning, the problem is going to be, Michael, is sight lines. So the nice way to remember a full moon is that it's the opposite of the sun in everything it does. So when the sun sets, the full moon rises. But when the full moon is setting, the sun is rising.
So just look west.
So you have to look west. And the good news is if you live in Pacifica, you have an unobstructed view of the west. But if you live in many places in the Bay Area, looking west is difficult because there are hills and buildings in the way. So you do have to get good sight lines toward the western horizon. And the later in the morning you're looking, the more low in the west it's going to be.
Actually, this is, I said this in the introduction, this is the second full moon in a month, or this month, excuse me, and the third supermoon month in a row. What are we to make of that?
So these are more numerical coincidences. There's nothing to see for these. But we astronomers call it a blue moon when two full moons happen in the same month. And we had a full moon on New Year's Day, and now we're having another one at the end of January, which, by the way, means that February gets ripped off and there'll be no full moon in February. But this is just a kind of coincidence that happens pretty regularly. What's interesting is that the blue moon, the eclipse of the moon, and yet another phenomenon, which the media have started calling the supermoon, are all happening at the same time. In the supermoon, the moon, as it goes around the Earth, is sometimes a little closer, a little further away. And we have a supermoon when the full moon happens, just as the moon is a little bit closer to us in its orbit. So this is going to be a full moon, an eclipsed moon, a super moon, and a blue moon.
Boy, this is about the first time in, a century and a half we've seen something
so,
like this?
So we don't keep track of super moons. That's really kind of a new idea that actually mostly the public is aware of. But we do keep track of blue moons and eclipses of the moon. And this is the first eclipsed blue moon in over 150 years, 152 years. Now, the next one will be in 2028, so they're not always that rare. And this is a U.S. measurement. Elsewhere in the world, we've had an eclipsed blue moon between that 150-year period. But still, you can say once in a century and a half, you have to get up for this.
But it's especially visible on the West Coast here, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So the eclipses of the moon are much more democratic than the eclipses of the sun that we talked about this summer. Here, anywhere on Earth where you can see the moon, you can see the eclipse of the moon. The problem is, on the East Coast, the moon has already set. The sun has come up when the eclipse is happening. Whereas here on the West Coast, we get treated to the entire spectacular sequence.
Well, if you get up early enough, you can see it. I keep hearing the Marcells and Frank Sinatra in my head, along with Billie Holiday. Many versions of Blue Moon, of course, and this is really a blue moon. You're going to actually, well, not so much blue. It turns the moon an eerie kind of dark red because of fending off the red light in the Earth's atmosphere. And once that's over, the reddish effect is over. So be advised to look out and see this. By the way, if you have any questions about it, we'd like to hear from you. The super blue lunar eclipse coming Wednesday morning, quite rare, and indeed many of you may have some thoughts about it. And if you do, or if you have questions about astronomy, because Andy Fracknick can answer just about any you might have in your mind, except whether there's exobiology or life out there. We still have SETI seeking that, but he's got about anything else in his craw. You can join us toll-free. It's 866-733-6786. We do invite your calls, so feel free to join the program. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Andrew Fracknoy is professor of astronomy now at San Francisco State's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. He's also professor emeritus in the astronomy program at Foothill College. And I know there are many people who have questions about astronomy in general. Let's talk about some things that I kind of hinted at. We're learning about maybe where gold came from in the universe.
Right. Just before we do that, can I say one other thing about the eclipse? Because people may be wondering, for the eclipse this summer, the eclipse of the sun, you have to have special glasses.
Right.
So people associate eclipses with danger to your eyes. And so I just wanted to be sure that we say that this eclipse, the lunar eclipse, is perfectly safe to look at. You don't need glasses. You don't need binoculars or anything. You can see it with your naked eye. It's much more democratic than the eclipse we had.
And much less perilous, we should
have. Yes, that's right.
So let's talk, though, about these kind of cases now that are coming forward about discovery, not only gold, but other elements.
That's right.
Origins.
So this has been a big problem in astronomy for a while now. When I was growing up, we learned, Carl Sagan was very good at saying that we are all star stuff, that the material in our
stuff
bodies,
upon which stars are made. Yeah.
That's right. That the material in our bodies, the atoms of which we are constructed, come ultimately from the stars. We think when the universe began, it began very simple with only two elements in it, hydrogen and helium. And all the other atoms, all the things that we have in our bodies, like carbon and nitrogen and oxygen, all of these are made by stars as part of the natural business of being a star. And that works really nicely up to about iron. Stars, in the natural course of their lives, make elements up to iron. But we didn't know where elements beyond iron came from. For a long time, we learned that exploding stars did this, that stars that at the end of their lives don't just die, but actually blow themselves to pieces. In the explosion of stars, we can forge heavier elements like the ones we all like, gold, silver, platinum, uranium, etc. But better calculations showed that that wasn't so easy. exploding stars weren't as good at making gold and other heavy elements as we thought. You needed an even greater explosion. Where would we find an even bigger explosion than one star blowing itself up? Well, if two stars collide, especially if two dead stars collide.
These are called star corpses.
Star corpses is what I like to call them. You're absolutely right. And if they collide, they explode in an even greater cataclysm than just a single star exploding. We've never seen such an incredible collision of dead stars. But just last year, we began a whole new era in astronomy, which astronomers are calling multi-messenger astronomy, where this kind of explosion, two dead stars merging together, became visible not just with light and radio waves and X-rays, but also with something Einstein predicted, gravity waves. Gravity waves were first found from this object. Later, light was seen, and that allowed us to pinpoint where in the universe they came from.
So you got gravity waves and light from this merger. Yeah.
That's right. And it's never happened before that the same object has given us both kinds of messengers. And once we saw the explosion with light and X-rays, we could measure what was happening, and indeed, it is making heavier elements. It looks like it's making gold and silver and platinum. So we may owe some of the jewelry that we so much enjoy to the explosion of to an explosion that happens when two star corpses collide. I'm not sure if that's a romantic way to introduce the subject to your sweetheart when you're proposing, but that's what we're discovering.
Bear that in mind, those of you who are giving a diamond ring or whatever. We're going to go to our callers here in just a moment. A lot of people have questions for you, as I anticipated, but what is this about black holes burping?
Yes, so this is another kind of star corpse, as long as we're on the subject of star corpses, is a black hole. A black hole is where a really huge star has collapsed under its own weight. And it's collapsed so much, its gravity has become so incredibly intense that nothing, not even light, can escape. And we call these a black hole. And black holes can merge together. They can eat things in their neighborhood. And we now think that all the great galaxies or islands of stars in the universe have a super black hole in the middle, a black hole which is full of material. Millions, sometimes billions of stars worth of material has trapped inside the black hole. And these black holes are hungry. They like to eat, and if anything comes near them, they eat material, they absorb it, and when it's being fed to them too fast, they burp a little bit. Your little brother has these problems,
like too. Pac-Man, but with the belching.
There you go. But actual belching with a bubble of material coming out. And we often see this, that a black hole is eating, and then there's a burp as it finishes its meal. Here we've seen a galaxy far, far away, which burped twice. We've been able to observe a burp two times in a row, and that's never been seen before. So that was news in the world of astronomy.
Also, you're talking about, a galaxy far, far away. Discovery of a distant galaxy kind of tells us more about the Big Bang, too.
Well, now this is really exciting stuff that's happening in astronomy. This is a key idea that we have to really get our minds around. The further out you look in astronomy, the longer ago you are seeing. So that's something you need to think about. If I see something out there where light takes 100 years to get to us, a star, we say is 100 light years away, light at the speed of light takes 100 years to get to Earth. So we see it as it was 100 years ago. If we see another galaxy, a giant island of stars, 10 million light years away, that means the light we see tonight took 10 million years to get to us, and we're seeing it as it was 10 million years ago. Now, with modern telescopes and light intensifiers like you have in good cameras, we are able to look out more than 13 billion light years. 13,000 million light years. That means we're looking back more than 13 billion years in the history of the universe. And there we're beginning to see the proto-galaxies, the baby galaxies that will someday grow up to be grown-up galaxies like our own Milky Way. We are able to see them at the beginning of time. And there's a record holder. That's the big announcement was that we saw one that was only a few hundred million years after the beginning, after the Big Bang. But we are seeing, for the first time, baby galaxies, galaxies in the process of being born out in the distance of the universe.
Let's go to our callers. And a lot of interest in the blue moon here and the matters astronomical. And let's begin with Mandeep. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing there? Hi, Andrew. Thanks for all your work you've done for astronomy. I'm actually an astronomer. I work on Dark Energy Survey, which saw one of it was one of the first ones that saw the optical counterpart of the binary neutron star. My question is going to be a little closer to Earth, which is I'm just interested in what we learn about pollution from, you talked about the color on the moon and what people have been able to deduce about the atmosphere and how they've used that from looking at the colors during these eclipses.
Right. So this is not an exact science by any means, but this is the same as you get when you have a sunset. Our listeners may know that when the atmosphere is especially polluted, you get a really red sunset. When a volcano has gone off on Earth, right around the volcano, the dust and ash gives you much redder sunset as the light of the sun is bent through the Earth's atmosphere. So there's a similar effect here. The more polluted and the more volcanically active the Earth is, the redder these full moons become. So people who are experts at judging this can tell something about the pollution of the Earth's atmosphere by how red and what color red the lunar eclipse is. But that's something we leave to experts. People should just enjoy the blood red moon tomorrow morning.
Let me thank Mandy for the call. I'll go to another caller here in a moment. But one of the other things you learn is, guess what? The Earth is indeed round, like the Greeks thought it was. Now we've got this wrapper. How does he pronounce it? Bobo or B-O-B-O?
B-O-B, I think.
B-O-B, who's saying he's arguing with Neil deGrasse Tyson, no less, that the Earth is flat. Of course, Tyson's saying, no, it's not. It's round. This is a guy who also denies the Holocaust and says that there was never a moon landing. So I don't know, put things in perspective here. Right.
And there's a basketball player also claiming that the Earth is flat. And so what you're bringing up is exactly right, Michael, that one of the earliest ways that human beings had of telling the shape of the Earth was to try to find the Earth's shadow. You know from personal experience that the shadow of your car looks like your car and the shadow of your little brother looks like your little brother. So people reasoned in ancient Greece, if we could see the shadow of the Earth, that would tell us the shape of the Earth. But the shadow of the Earth is black. Space is black. Good luck in finding it. But once in a blue moon, if I can put it this way, when the Earth's shadow goes across the moon in these lunar eclipses, you can see the shape of the Earth's shadow. And eclipse after eclipse, the Greeks saw that the shadow of the Earth was exactly round as it went across the moon. And from the fact that it was always round-shaped, they were able to decide, yes, the Earth must be a round planet. And we knew that long before Columbus and Magellan.
And here's Amy. Amy, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to say I'm so grateful to be catching your show right now this morning. And my daughter and I saw the eclipse of the sun last, I think it was August.
Yes.
And we would love to be able to see the eclipse of the moon as well. But I live in Fair Oaks, which is east of Sacramento. Where would I have to go to see it since it's going to be over the ocean?
So the only thing you need is a western horizon. So you need to kind of think about tonight when you see the sun set, that gives you a pretty good sense of where west is. Can you see where the sun is setting from your house? Now, the earlier you get up, the higher the eclipsed moon will be. So if you have something toward the lower part of your western horizon, the trick is get up a little earlier. Get up at 5 instead of 6, and you can see the eclipse higher. But what our listeners are going to have to do is to figure out their western horizon. What can they see looking low toward the west? The other problem, which we haven't mentioned, by the way, for those of us here in San Francisco, is going to be fog. If it's foggy, you won't be able to see the eclipse. So the question is, can you get high enough to see the eclipse in San Francisco? And we won't talk about the puns in that sentence. And also, can you see toward the west?
Well, we hope. Indeed, Amy, that you and your daughter get to see it. Just look west, and thank you for the call. Let me get another caller on here right away. That's Martin in Santa Clara. Martin, welcome.
Hey, thanks. Great show. Actually, two questions. Why is it that the moon, we only see one side of it? Is it this perfect synchronicity, and is it unusual in celestial environments? And also, as we look out 13 billion light years, is it possible through gravitational refraction that we are ultimately looking back on ourselves?
Great questions. Let's take them in order. So this is something that many people are not aware of, but the moon goes around the Earth in the same time that it goes around itself, that it spins. And if you don't know what that means, I suggest you try it in your living room. Have somebody in the family go around another person at the same rate that they go around themselves, that they turn their shoulders. And you will wind up, if you start with your belly button facing the person in the middle, you'll always have your belly button side facing the person in the middle. That's called synchronous rotation. And as your question suggests, that's pretty common. When gravity grabs things, as a planet-moon combination does, it often winds up in this kind of synchronous rotation where only one side is visible from the planet. Now, the other question had to do with, can we, by the bending of light, look out into the most distant parts of the universe and somehow see ourselves? And that sounds like a fascinating science fiction idea for Black Mirror, but it's not reality. What I think the person was thinking about is that one of the reasons we can see faint galaxies way out there is a trick that, again, Einstein came up with called gravitational lensing. The gravity of things between us and these distant galaxies can sometimes strengthen the light, can intensify the light, like can happen in a funhouse mirror. And so gravitational lensing helps us to see these more distant galaxies.
And a reminder, you were listening to the Forum program. We're talking with Andrew Fracknoy, who's here with us in the studio. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to a caller in Sarasota, Florida, and that's you, Lynn. Hi, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm so happy I got through. I live on the East Coast, but of course Sarasota faces the Gulf of Mexico, so it's on the West Coast of Florida. And I'm wondering how much I would be able to see of the eclipse and the blood moon if I got up early.
So all you would be able to see on the East Coast will be the beginning of the eclipse. When the eclipse first starts to happen, when the moon first starts going into the shadow of the Earth, you'll be able to see that part just as the full moon is setting. But by the time the total eclipse happens, unfortunately, the moon will have set on the East Coast in the Eastern time zone.
Thank you for the call, Lynn, and I hope you get to see something in that. We got an Alberta, Canada caller next. Neil, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call. Now, the Big Bang happened somewhere, a single point in space somewhere, apparently. And so all of the stuff in the universe is flying out away from that point radially. Has anybody figured out where that point was?
That's a great question, and I have a disappointing but weird answer for you, which is that we think the Big Bang happened everywhere. That wherever...
So we call it the ubiquitous Big Bang.
That's right. In every point in space, as space began to expand, the Big Bang was happening. So there's no special location where Disney can sell expensive tickets and have you be admitted to the point of the Big Bang. The Big Bang happened everywhere in the universe, and the universe has been expanding. And in fact, the energy of the Big Bang, the leftover echo of the explosion, is everywhere. And that's how we've been able to pick it up. The best proof of the Big Bang is that the echo, the leftover energy of the explosion, is everywhere around us, and our instruments can tune into it. Several people have gotten the Nobel Prize for tuning in to the echo of the Big Bang, and it demonstrates my really crazy statement that it's all over the universe that the Big Bang happened.
And thank you, Neil, for your call. We'll go right to another caller. AJ, you're on. Good morning.
Well, hi. Thanks, Michael. Hi, Andrew. You know, I was just listening to you while driving, and, you know, as a kid, I was always fascinated with this, and listening to you gives me chills, you know.
Nice tribute. Thank you for that. Want to say anything to him about your aesthetic way of speaking, or how astronomy is aesthetic, really?
I think really that this is something I've developed over the years with help from radio hosts and students, people like you, Michael, that astronomy is fascinating to a lot of people, but it seems so remote and full of jargon and mathematics. And one thing I've worked very hard to do is to take astronomy, make it sort of come alive in everyday language. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm teaching, as you said, at the San Francisco State Program for Retired Adults, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. And we're having a lot of fun with people who have retired but want to come back to school and learn more about exciting things. And they are full of questions. I mean, they're like your listeners here on KQED. And so we're having a great time exploring.
Well, you got astronomy. The older people. You also got a book for kids, right?
We wrote a book on eclipses for kids called When the Sun Goes Dark. And that does have a section about lunar eclipses. So if people want to pick that up after the eclipse to explain things to their kids, that would be nice. When the Sun Goes Dark.
Here's a tweet from Catherine. It says, this may seem like a silly question, but do eclipses affect ocean tides? They seem unrelated, but who knows?
Well, the moon affects ocean tides, so it's much more the supermoon part of this. The fact that the Earth and the moon are closer to each other would mean slightly higher tides, but nothing that you need to worry about.
And here's Vern, who wants to know, can the astronomer, that's you, Andrew,
yeah.
please tell us what color the moon would have been, if not blue, 3 billion years ago when the Earth's atmosphere had 10 to 100 times more carbon dioxide?
Oh, my goodness. So, yes, not only that, but billions of years ago, the moon was closer to the Earth. We know that the moon is very slowly moving away. So, and the atmosphere would have been completely different. So the refractive properties. So the answer to this question is, I have no idea. That's a really good question where we'd have to sit down and calculate what happens.
So, do you have any idea what's on the dark side of the moon?
Well, we do that. The other side of the moon, the unseen side of the moon, is not always dark. But we do know that it's actually a little bit different from the side we see.
A little bit different.
A little bit different, but still pretty much like
green cheese?
No, not too much green cheese. We've been disappointed in that.
Well, never disappointed to have you aboard here. Thank you so much for joining us. Always good to see you. And again, Andrew Fracknoy, sign up for his course if you haven't had the opportunity to do so in the Lifelong Learning, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at San Francisco State. He's also Professor Emeritus in the astronomy program at Foothill, and we have another hour of forum coming up. We're going to talk about the link between childhood trauma and poor health and what to do to break that link with physician and pediatrician Natalie Burke-Harris. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.